You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Esoteric Christianity and the Mission of Christian Rosenkreutz, translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 3, entitled Buddha and Christ, the Sphere of the Bodhisattvas, given in Milan on the 21st of September, 1911. Today I want to speak of certain facts belonging essentially to the ethical and moral domain that help us to understand the mission of spiritual science in our time. We are all deeply convinced of the great truth of reincarnation, and so must realize that this repetition of earthly lives has its own good purpose in the evolution of the earth. Occult research answers the question as to why we reincarnate by saying that our experiences differ in each of the epochs in which we are reborn on the earth. In incarnations immediately following the Atlantean catastrophe, the experiences of the human soul were entirely different from those of later pre-Christian epochs and in our own age. I need only briefly mention that in the times directly after the Atlantean catastrophe, souls were endowed with a certain elementary clairvoyance in the bodies they then inhabited. This clairvoyance, once a natural faculty in man, was gradually lost, mainly as a result of the conditions prevailing during the Greco-Roman epoch of culture. Since then, man has developed in such a way that great progress has been achieved on the physical plane, and during the course of the present post-Atlantean epoch, clairvoyance will gradually be reacquired. We are living in the fifth post-Atlantean epoch of culture. The ancient Indian was the first, the ancient Persian the second, the Babylonian Chaldean the third, and the Greco-Roman the fourth. The sixth and seventh epochs will follow our own, at which time another great catastrophe will befall the earth and humanity, as was the case at the end of the Atlantean epoch. Occult research is able to indicate the characteristic trend of human evolution in each of these post-Atlantean epochs of civilization, including the fifth, sixth, and seventh. The essential characteristic of our present fifth epoch is the development of intellect and reason. The main characteristic of the sixth will be that definite feelings regarding what is moral and what is immoral will arise in human souls. Delicate feelings of sympathy will be aroused by compassionate, kindly deeds, and feelings of antipathy by malicious actions. Nobody today has the faintest conception of the intensity of these feelings. In the seventh epoch, the moral life will be still further deepened. Whereas in the sixth epoch, man will take pleasure in good and noble actions, in the seventh, the natural outcome of such pleasure will be a moral impulse. In other words, there will be a firm resolve to do what is moral. There is a great difference between taking pleasure in a moral action and the doing of it. So we can say that our own epoch is the epoch of intellectualism. The essential characteristic of the following epoch will be aesthetic pleasure in good and aesthetic displeasure in evil. The seventh will be characterized by an active moral life. Today, only the seeds of what will become part of mankind in future epochs are contained in the human soul. And it can be said that all these intellectual aptitudes or predispositions in man, leading to feelings of sympathy or antipathy toward moral impulses aroused by certain actions, are related to the higher worlds. Every moral action has a definite connection with the higher worlds. Our intellectual aptitudes have a supersensible connection with the astral plane. Our sympathies and antipathies for good or evil are connected with the sphere of lower Devakan, and the domain of moral impulses in the soul is connected with higher Devakan. Hence, we can also say that in our present age, it is mainly the forces of the astral world that penetrate the human soul and take effect there. In the sixth epoch, it will be the forces of lower Devakan that penetrate more deeply into the soul. And in the seventh, the forces of higher Devakan will work with special strength into humanity. From this it is understandable that in the preceding fourth post-Atlantean epoch, it was the forces of the physical plane that exercised the strongest influence on the soul of man. That is why Greek culture was able to produce such wonderful sculptures, in which the human form was given such magnificent expression on the physical plane. Conditions in that epoch were especially suitable for people to experience the Christ in a physical body. In our present fifth epoch, which will last until the fourth millennium, souls will gradually become able, from the 20th century onward, to experience the Christ being in an etheric form on the astral plane, just as in the fourth epoch he was visible in a physical form on the physical plane. To understand the nature of development in the sixth epoch, it is well to consider the characteristic qualities of the soul in future incarnations. In our intellectual age today, intellectuality and morality are practically separate spheres in the life of the soul. It is quite possible for someone to be clever and at the same time immoral, or vice versa, to be deeply moral and anything but clever. In the fourth epoch, the future juxtaposition of morality and intellectuality was prophetically foreseen by the Hebrews. They endeavored to bring about an artificial harmony between morality and intellectuality, whereas among the Greeks it was a more natural matter of course. Today we can learn from the Akashic records how the leaders of the ancient Hebrews strove to establish this harmony between intellectuality and morality. They wore symbols, which they understood so profoundly that when they concentrated their attention on them, making themselves receptive to their influences, a certain harmony was established between what was good in a moral sense and what was wise. The ancient Hebrew priests wore these symbols on their breastplates. The symbol for morality was called Urim, U-R-I-M, and for wisdom, Thummim. When a Hebrew priest wanted to learn whether or not a certain action was both good and wise, he made himself receptive to the forces of Urim and Thummim, with the result that a certain harmony between morality and intellectuality was induced. Magical effects were produced by means of these symbols, and a magical link thus established with the spiritual world. Our task, in future incarnations, is to achieve through inner development of the soul the effect that in earlier times was produced by means of these symbols. Let us think once again of the fifth, sixth, and seventh post-Atlantean epochs in order to grasp the way in which intellectuality, aestheticism, and morality will come to expression in man's soul life. In the present fifth epoch, intellectuality can remain unimpaired even if no pleasure is taken in moral actions. In the sixth epoch, it will be quite different, in that, from about the third millennium onward, immorality will have a paralyzing effect on intellectuality. The mental abilities of someone who is intellectual and at the same time immoral will definitely deteriorate, and this condition will become gradually more pronounced as man evolves. A person who has no morals will then have no intellectual power, since this will depend entirely on moral actions. In the seventh epoch, cleverness without morality will be non-existent. It will be well to consider here the nature of moral forces in souls in their present incarnations. How can it be that at our stage of evolution a person can become immoral? It is because in earlier incarnations we have gradually descended into the physical sensory world. the more forcefully the impulses belonging to the descending phase of evolution work upon a soul, the more immoral it tends to become. This fact is confirmed by an interesting finding of occult research. You know that when we pass through the gate of death, we lay aside our physical and etheric bodies, and for a short time have a retrospective view of our past life on earth. A kind of sleep then ensues, and after a few months or perhaps years, we waken on the astral plane in Kamaloka. The earthly life just departed is lived over again in backward order, three times as fast. At the beginning of this life in Kamaloka, everyone undergoes a significant experience. Most Europeans, or speaking generally, people of modern civilization, experience this as follows. At the beginning of life in Kamaloka, a spiritual individuality shows us a kind of register of our transgressions, in which is inscribed everything we have done out of selfish motives. The more concretely you picture this experience, the better. At the beginning of the Kamaloka period, it is actually as though an individual were presenting you with a record of your physical life. The important fact, for which naturally there can be no further proof because it can be confirmed only by occult experience, is that the majority of Europeans recognize this individual to be Moses. This has been known to Rosicrucian research since the Middle Ages, and it has been confirmed in recent years by very painstaking, delicate investigations. You can gather from this that at the beginning of life in Kamaloka, one feels a great responsibility toward the pre-Christian powers inasmuch as they have drawn us downward. The powers and forces that draw us upward again to the spiritual world fall into two categories. The one path is that of wisdom, the other that of morality. The forces to which intellectual progress is mainly due all proceed from the impulse given by a great individuality of the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, who is known to all of you, namely Gautama Buddha. It is a remarkable discovery of spiritual investigation to find that the most penetrating and significant thoughts conceived in our present epoch originated with Gautama Buddha. This is all the more remarkable inasmuch as his name was almost unknown in the West before Schopenhauer's time, by no means long ago. As we know, Siddhartha, the son of King Suddhodana, rose from the rank of a bodhisattva to that of Buddha when he was 29 years old. An individual who has been raised to Buddhahood does not incarnate again on earth in a physical body. The bodhisattva individuality who became Buddha 5 or 6 centuries before the Christian era has not reincarnated, nor can he incarnate again in a physical body. Instead, he sends his forces down from the higher supersensible worlds, inspiring all those cultured individuals who are not yet permeated by the Christ impulse. Consciousness of this truth was demonstrated in a beautiful legend written by John of Damascus in the 8th century and well known throughout Europe in the Middle Ages. This legend of Bar-Lam and Josaphat related how the successor of Buddha, Josaphat, whose name is a phonetic variation of Bodhisattva, received instructions from Bar-Lam about the Christ impulse. The legend was subsequently forgotten, but it told how the Bodhisattva who succeeded Gautama Buddha was instructed by Bar-Lam, and his soul was fired by the Christ impulse. In addition to the impulse of Buddha, this Christ impulse, which is connected with the future ascent of man to morality, also continued to work in man's evolution. Although Buddha's teaching is in a particular sense moral teaching, the Christ impulse is not a teaching, but actual power. It works as such, and to an increasing degree imbues man with moral strength. In the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, the Christ being who descended from cosmic heights had first to appear in a physical body. In our fifth epoch, the intense consolidation of intellectual forces will make it possible for human beings to behold the Christ in an etheric form. This is beginning even now in our century. From the 30s to the 40s of this century onward, individuals will appear who have developed in a way that will enable them to see the etheric form of Christ, just as they saw the physical Christ at the time of Jesus of Nazareth. During the next 3,000 years, those able to behold the etheric Christ will steadily increase until about 3,000 years from now, a plentiful number of human beings on earth will not need gospels or such records. They will possess in their own soul, lives, an actual vision of the Christ. We must clearly understand that in the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, people were only capable of beholding the physical Christ, and so he came in a physical body. In our own epoch and on into the third millennium, they will gradually become able to behold the etheric Christ. He will never come again in a physical body. If we bear in mind the fact that when a person of the present age, who has united himself deeply with the Christ impulse, passes into Kamaloka, and is called to account by a figure personifying a moral force, by Moses, we shall understand how a transformation of the Moses individuality can be brought about. What does Moses show us when he confronts us with the record of our sins and transgressions? He reveals the debit side of our karmas. For a soul of our epoch, it is of great significance that the doctrine of karma can be comprehended through the inspiration of Buddha. The reality of the working of karma after death, however, is revealed to us by Moses of the Old Testament. As the influences of the supersensible Christ increasingly pervade human souls, the figure of Moses will be replaced after death by that of Christ Jesus. This means that human karma will be linked with Christ. Christ will unite with our karmas. It is interesting to realize that in the teachings of Buddha, karma is an abstract matter having an impersonal character. In the future incarnations of human beings, as Christ comes into ever closer connection with karma, it will acquire the quality of being, that is, of potential life. Our earlier stages of evolution, our lives in the past, may be related to the words ex Deo nascimur. If we direct our development in such a way that we meet Christ after death instead of Moses, Christ with whom our karmas are then united, we can express it in the words used in Rosicrucian Christianity since the 13th century, in Christo morimur. Buddhahood can be attained only on the physical plane. The qualification for meeting Christ in death can likewise be acquired by the human soul only on the physical plane. A Buddha is first a bodhisattva and rises to the rank of Buddha during a physical incarnation. It is then no longer necessary for him to return to the earth. Understanding of Christ in the sense just explained can be acquired only on the physical plane. Hence, during the next 3,000 years, people will have to acquire in the physical world the power to behold the supersensible Christ. It is the mission of the spiritual science movement to create, first of all, the conditions that make understanding of Christ possible on the physical plane, and then to make possible the power to behold him. If on the physical plane we have acquired the capacity to behold Christ, we can then do so while living in a physical body or when we are between death and a new birth. Let us suppose, for example, that someone died before it was possible to behold Christ in his present etheric form. Nevertheless, if during his life in the physical world he had acquired the necessary understanding, vision of the Christ would be possible for him between death and rebirth. someone, however, who keeps aloof from spiritual life and acquires no understanding of Christ will have to wait until his next incarnation to acquire it. What has just been said will indicate that as humanity lives on through the fifth, sixth, and seventh epochs of civilization, the Christ impulse will gain increasing power on the earth. We have heard that in the sixth epoch, intellectuality will be impaired by immorality. The other aspect is that someone who has paralyzed his intellectual faculty as a result of immorality must turn to Christ with all the greater determination, so that he may imbue him with the moral strength to return to morality. What I have told you here has been carefully investigated by Rosicrucians ever since the 13th century. It is a truth, however, that has always been known to many occultists. If it were to be asserted that Christ could appear again on earth in a physical body, it would, according to occultism, be equivalent to asserting that a pair of scales works more efficiently when supported at two points rather than one. The 3 years of Christ's life on earth in the body of Jesus of Nazareth truly constitutes the fulcrum of earth evolution. Just as there can be only one point at which the scale beam is attached, so there can be only one fulcrum of earth evolution. The teaching of moral development is not the same as the impulse for such development. Before the event of Golgotha occurred, the Bodhisattva, who is the successor to Buddha, was incarnated on earth to teach and prepare those around him for that event. He incarnated in the personality of Jeshu ben Pandira, 1 century before the birth of Jesus of Nazareth. Thus, we must distinguish between the Jeshu ben Pandira incarnation of the Bodhisattva who succeeded Gautama Buddha and the incarnation of Jesus of Nazareth, who for 3 years was permeated by the cosmic being we call the Christ. This Bodhisattva who incarnated in Jeshu ben Pandira and also in others, returns repeatedly. About 3,000 years hence, he will attain Buddhahood, and as the Maitreya Buddha, will live through his final incarnation. The Christ individuality was on earth in the body of Jesus of Nazareth for only 3 years, and will not come again in a physical body. In the fifth post-Atlantean epoch, he will come in an etheric body, in the sixth, in an astral body, and in the seventh, in a mighty cosmic ego that will be like a great group soul of humanity. When a person dies, his physical, etheric, and astral bodies fall away from him, and his ego passes over to the next incarnation. It is exactly the same with the earth. What is physical in our earth falls away at the end of the earth period, and human souls, in their totality, pass over into the Jupiter condition, the next planetary embodiment. Just as the ego of an individual person is the center of his further evolution, so, for the whole of future humanity, the Christ ego in human astral and etheric bodies goes on to ensoul the Jupiter existence. So we see how, starting from physical existence on earth, the Christ gradually evolves as etheric Christ, astral Christ, and ego Christ to become the spirit of the earth, who then rises to even higher stages together with all mankind. What are we doing when we profess spiritual science today, but teaching what Oriental wisdom so clearly proclaimed when the Bodhisattva, the son of King Suddhodana, attained Buddhahood? The realization was expressed in those Oriental teachings that it was the task of the next Bodhisattva, who would also eventually become a Buddha, to spread over the earth the knowledge that would reveal Christ to us in his true light. Thus the Bodhisattva who incarnated in Jeshu ben Pandira and in others became the great teacher of the Christ impulse, This is clearly indicated in the legend of Balaam and Josaphat, that tells how Josaphat, the Bodhisattva, is instructed by Balaam, the Christian teacher. Oriental occult teachings call this Bodhisattva, who will become the Maitreya Buddha, the bringer of the good. We know from occult investigations that the power of the word will be present in Maitreya Buddha, in a degree which people today can, as yet, have no conception of. Through higher clairvoyant perception of the process of world evolution, it is possible to discover how the Maitreya Buddha will teach 3,000 years from now. Much of his teaching can also be expressed in symbolic forms. But because mankind today is insufficiently mature, it is not yet possible to speak words such as those that will come from the lips of the Maitreya Buddha. In the Eightfold Path, Gautama Buddha gave the great intellectual teachings of right speech, right thinking, right action, etc. The words of the Maitreya Buddha will contain a magic power that will become moral impulses in those who hear them. Should there be a gospel telling of the Maitreya Buddha, it would have to use different words than those used by Christ in the Gospel of St. John, quote, "and the Word was made flesh," close quote. The evangelist of the Maitreya Buddha would have to testify, quote, "and the flesh was made word." The pronouncements of the Maitreya Buddha will be permeated in a miraculous way with the power of Christ. Occult investigations today show that in a certain respect, even the external life of the Maitreya Buddha will be patterned on the life of Christ. When, in ancient times, a great individuality appeared, who was to become a teacher of humanity, it was indicated by signs, special talents, and qualities of soul evident in his early youth. But there is also a different development, in which a complete change in personality becomes apparent at a certain point in life. In such instances, when the individual has reached a certain age, his ego is removed from his bodily sheaths and is replaced by another. Jesus is the most outstanding example of this development, in that in his 30th year, the Christ individuality took possession of him. All the incarnations of the Bodhisattva, who will become the Maitreya Buddha, have shown that in this sense his life too will resemble that of Christ. It is never known during the childhood or youth of an individual that he will become a Bodhisattva at the age of 30 or thereabouts. Also, whenever a Bodhisattva reaches Buddhahood, there is evidence that at the age of 30 or 31, another individuality takes possession of his body. Such a Bodhisattva will never reveal himself in his early youth, but in his 30th or 31st year, he will manifest quite different qualities, because another being has taken possession of his body. Other individualities who will not incarnate as children, but who will take possession of the personality of some human being in this way, are, for example, Moses, Abraham, and Ezekiel. Today it is the same in the case of the Bodhisattva, who in 3,000 years will become the Maitreya Buddha. It would be sheer occult dilettantism to assert that this being would be recognizable in his early years as the Bodhisattva. But between his 30th and 31st years, he will reveal himself through his own power, without having to be proclaimed by others. He will convince the world through his own power, and if he were alleged by some to reveal himself in someone under the age of 30, that fact alone would be evidence of the fallacy of such a statement. Claims like this have frequently been made. In the 17th century, for example, Shabbatai Tsevi, in Smyrna, proclaimed himself to be an incarnation of the Messiah, or Christ. Hosts of people from all over Europe made pilgrimages to him in Smyrna. It is certainly true that today there is a rooted disinclination to recognize genius in people. But, on the other hand, the sort of mental laziness is prevalent, which leads to people being only too ready to acknowledge some individual or other as a great soul merely on authority. It is important for the science of the spirit to be presented in such a way as to be based to the smallest extent possible on belief in authority. Much that I have said today can be substantiated only by means of occult investigation. Yet I beg you not to give credence to these things because I say them, but to test them by everything known to you from history, and above all by what you can learn from your own experience. I am absolutely certain that the more closely you examine them, the more confirmation you will find. In this age of intellectualism, I do not appeal to your belief in authority, but to your capacity for intelligent examination. So let me repeat what I have already said. The Bodhisattva of the 20th century will not rely upon a herald to announce him as the future Maitreya Buddha, but upon the power of his own words. He will stand on his own feet in the world. What has been said here may perhaps be summed up as follows. In our period of evolution, two streams of spiritual life are at work. One of them is the stream of wisdom, or the Buddha stream, containing the most sublime teaching of wisdom, goodness of heart, and peace on earth. To enable this teaching of Buddha to permeate the hearts of all human beings, the Christ impulse is indispensable. The second stream is the Christ stream itself, that will lead humanity from intellectuality, by way of aesthetic feeling and insight, to morality. The greatest teacher of the Christ impulse will be that Bodhisattva who incarnates again and again, and who in 3,000 years will become the Maitreya Buddha. The statement contained in Oriental Chronicles is true. Exactly 5,000 years after Gautama Buddha attained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, the Maitreya Buddha will incarnate on earth for the last time. The succession of bodhisattvas and buddhas has no relation to the cosmic being we call Christ. It was a bodhisattva, not the Christ, who incarnated in the body of Jeshu ben Pandira. Christ incarnated in a physical body only once, for a period of 3 years. The bodhisattva appears in every century until he becomes the Maitreya Buddha. The mission of spiritual science today is to bring about a synthesis of religions. We can conceive of one form of religion in Buddhism, another form in Christianity. As evolution proceeds, the more closely do the different religions unite in the way that Buddha and Christ themselves are united in our hearts. This vista of the spiritual development of humanity brings home to us the need for the vitalizing impulse of spiritual science as a preparation for understanding the progress of culture and events in the great process of our evolution. The end of Lecture 3.